I'm going to read a short, very short Emily Dickinson poem about this subject. It's called After Great Pain, A Formal Feeling Comes. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious, like tombs. The stiff heart questions, was it he that bore, and yesterday or centuries before? The feet, mechanical, go round, of ground or air or aught, a wooden way, regardless grown, a quartz contentment like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow, first chill, then stupor, then the letting go.
I assume most of you were here for Elmer's session on his experience with Ginny's dying. I went through some of that with him because we're neighbors. I'm from Illinois also and was a good friend of Ginny as well. And so we had kept in touch a lot when this was happening and talked on the phone every week for a long time. And I remember the feeling when he first called and said, Ginny wants to talk to you, and I knew it was her goodbye. But I had many conversations with her after that, before it finally happened. Well, after he talked, called us, and I went up for Ginny's memorial service, and Elmer was moving out to Holden. And we said, I live right on Freeway 80 going across the country, and I said, when you're ready to go Holden, do you want to stop? And we'll come and meet you and have dinner with you, or you can come have dinner with us. So he called us as he left Chicago, and we met at Holiday Inn outside the city. It was already late at night, and he was going to get on some distance over to Nebraska or something like that, ways to go. But anyway, we did have supper together. That was on a Thursday night, and on Monday morning, my husband had a cerebral hemorrhage and collapsed and was never conscious for 19 days. And we tried to catch Elmer on the way out here. He hadn't gotten here yet to notify that this had happened. And so I went through the experience of not that period of the dying experience that he had, but one of no communication at all, no response. He had gotten up in the morning, and it was an icy morning. He went out to dump the trash and feed the birds, came in and called some neighbors and said, be careful when you go outdoors today, it's very slick. And after that conversation, he decided he was reading a real good book and started to read the book, and he said, I've got such a headache today, this morning, I think I'll go and lie down a while. And that was not unusual. He'd had a lot of headaches. And so I didn't really think anything of that. But he got up, he went up to lie down, he got up to go to the bathroom, and I heard the thump and knew he'd fallen. And he collapsed in the hallway on the way to the bathroom and just said, call a doctor, and it was his last word. So he lived for 19 days with support. And the part that was hard for me was it was in a, because he had no movement at all on his own, they did surgery too, and it was massive bleeding, and said if he were young, he probably would have made it, but he was already 74. And so the chances weren't very good, but they still insisted on doing the surgery. And I wanted to go along with that at that point to do what we could. But when there was no response at all, I knew he wasn't going to make it. You know, it was just prolonged agony to go through this. And I don't know what doctors call it, but it was a system of, after the surgery and it showed it didn't work very well, they tried some new method of injecting something so he was to help the circulation in the body and so forth. And it would take 4 days for this to work, and then you had a withdrawal period of that. You had to give time to work out again. So I went through that knowing all the time he probably was not going to make it. And because he didn't have any movement of his own, he had a real circulation problem. And so they brought in a rocking bed. And I don't know if any of you have experienced that, but awful. And that was to help him, and he was on this rocking bed continuously, which meant I could never sit by him, never hold his hands for anything. I had to dance around this table all the time. And then it was constant monitors in there, like 10 people the first night through, and then down to 7, 5, and so forth. and it didn't work at all. We tried all kinds of things for just to see if he would respond, and friends who were, since Beanie was a musician, we tried having people come in and play music to see if we'd have any movement at all. That didn't happen. And finally, the doctor wanted to try the dose again. And I caught the nurse and I said, let me talk to him. And so I know ethically he probably had to say he did not dying. That was what he answered me. And I just looked him square in the eye and I said, I want to let him die. And he looked at me good and hard and I said, you don't have to worry about a lawsuit. I'm not going to come back at you with that. And he said, okay, and got a big smile on his face. So then they withdrew all the life support, took him out of his rocking bed, and I had about 2 hours of an afternoon when he was on a straight bed. That was the hardest part for me, was to decide, you know, to have all this withdrawn. And when they finally took the oxygen away, he died within a half an hour. And my feeling at that point was death was indeed a gift. And that was how I responded and what I said. I'm so glad he could die. So that's my experience and how I had to handle it at the time. And now when we've had Vern Reapy here talking about all the legal problems with it, I'm so blessed that I didn't have any family that objected. I had a daughter that was clear over in Europe. I didn't have to go through that process. You know, the whole family was together on what we were to do. I was so grateful that no one objected to this withdrawing of support. And I would say, having gone through the experience, if you ever have to have somebody that's dying in your family, will you please let everyone come home, even if you think they don't know. I didn't do this with my daughter because she was in Europe, and we called almost daily, but I said, well, he won't know you. I'll need you more later. But when I realized what it did to us, the two boys and I, while we sat there those days, the solidarity that was there, the chance to talk about our faith, our church, the support, all the friends who called. I don't know what I would have done without all of them. We had calls coming constantly at the hospital, at home. It was just unbelievable. The nurses finally said, you know, people all over the country, I don't understand that. Well, this was holding, just calling from all over. Tremendous support on all that, during the illness, but also afterwards. And I was real sorry that my daughter wasn't home to experience that, because you can't explain it and you can't go through it. I'm just telling you. And looking back, I feel she missed so much not being there. And I was one who said, you don't have to come home. And it was very hard on her too. So I would say, even if they aren't conscious, please go home. And it does something to the family to be together. And then my other concern in wanting to do this is, what are our churches doing for support system? I have a lot from the hospital, also from my own church, but I've talked with Elmer. One mistake we made up here 2 years ago when we did this then, we did not ask his children. We sat here just talking about our loss, mm-hmm. but we didn't think about having the children say, what's the loss to me? And kids often get left out on this. I mean, they're in on it, but nobody finds out how you feel and what do they say to them. And I felt real bad about that. That was one reason I had a good visit with his daughter Barbara 2 weeks ago, and we shared some of those feelings. But, I had not asked her really before. So those were things I would like you to think about, and that your churches might think about, not just for mates, people who lose children, but to children themselves, to have somebody come and support them. Okay.
Thank you, thank you. Barbara, do you want to share something?
Okay, this is something we haven't talked about yet. Some people say the most painful loss is the death of a child for parents. So it's something really hard to recover from. Last year, our family, a cousin of mine, died of AIDS at the age of 25, and we talked about that a lot as a family, and talked with his parents, and I just thought I'd maybe read an excerpt from a letter that she wrote to us that was so meaningful. about the whole situation, and especially in terms of what it meant that it was AIDS, because there was a little support from the church and from the community, but still how it drew their family together. This is my cousin's mother writing. She nursed him through the experience. Basically, he got pneumonia several times, and then finally died the last time, and I'll just read starting more. She details that for, although it's a very long letter, telling about the whole experience. When I arrived, he was already in intensive care, and he died 3 days later. He had learned in August that he did have AIDS, and that certainly was very bad news, as he said. He was terrified of an agonizing death and mental deterioration, which so many people experience. We can be grateful that death came quickly and that he experienced the love and friendship of many up to the moment of death. I was by his side and spoke with him shortly before his death, and his father telephoned just 2 hours before he died. They lived in different cities. Following this experience, I feel a great empathy for the suffering and tears of the gay community in San Francisco and elsewhere. There is certainly work for the church to do here. Many of the young men have been rejected by their families, so they find themselves dying without their family's love or even their family's knowledge. The ignorance, fear, and lack of compassion of the larger community leaves a void that needs attention from the church. We have been surrounded with loving, supportive family and friends, and it pains me to think that other young men and their families cannot have this experience during such painful times. And maybe some of you have lost a son or a daughter and know what that's like.
Elmer, do you have something?
For those of you who were here, I just shared a short time ago. Let me just add to that comment that responding to the comment that Ingrid made about not necessarily having deep talks. Jenny, I told you there was a lot of humorous dimensions of her last days. When she finally came home from the hospital knowing that she was coming home to die, she would tell later, she says, I came home thinking now I had made this great decision and certainly I would come home and have profound thoughts. And the first thing she said God led me to do was darn the socks. So there was really a lot of prosaic kinds of stuff that happened. They were terribly, terribly ordinary. And she would, forgive me if this offends anybody, but she was supposed to be dying of cancer. And she really felt pretty good during a number of those days. She was still up and about and walking, and she couldn't eat any food, no longer anything. Everything was taken to the rectum and so forth, and couldn't even keep anything down. Every once in a while she'd say, I think I'll have a Big Mac. like what could it do? Kill me? We'd bring a Big Mac, and she'd take two or three bites, and of course couldn't keep anything down, but at least she enjoyed having a Big Mac. And then she would also, people are coming over, I better get in bed because I'm dying of cancer. So she would get in bed, and they would come and visit her, and that would be the normal procedure. And then they'd leave, and she got up. Once she got up, they were still in the kitchen. She had to run back in and get back in bed again. So there was a lot of terrible ordinariness about it too. But that all came through what Gertrude didn't have, and that was the weeks that we had with her for closure and all that. Again, as I said before, I don't know what it would have been like if it had been just past or close to.
Stories around Chicago about Ginny in those days were legion. That she would not die and go in and out of coma. It was very interesting to hear all those.
Well, let me tell one more. We had pictures taken. She, of course, shortly after her first chemo, lost all of her hair. And that was not really a tough thing. She called up and found out it was going to cost $365 or something for a piece and all that stuff. So she, this is really true of her life. I can do better at Kmart. So she went to Kmart, found a marvelous wig, bought eventually six of them. You know, she's going to be at this for a while. She was all for, I think, $8.95 or something like that. It was just marvelous. But then it was her idea that each of us had our picture taken. And she and I had pictured him each with the wig on, and then each of us taken with no hair at all. So we put two of them on one side with the hair, and then we showed that to people, and we turned it over, and then without the hair, and our line, beneath the line was, the longer you live together, the more you look alike.
That was their Christmas letter.
Yeah.
She was cleaning, wondering about, once when I called, she was concerned about the Elmer, and who's going to clean out under the sink when I'm not here to do it?
You should go look under his sink.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, Elmer, was there a point, I'm back here.
Sure.
Okay. I find it hard to believe that at some point she didn't have some anger at it. She was a young woman still. Did she go through a process of grieving and anger and denial, and
Nope.
Take it as...
The doctor was very, the first oncologist was very upset with me. Talked to me about it a number of times. And I finally said, hey, Doc, you got to talk to her. You know, she says, you deny, you're just not dealing with an idea. And I told Jenny, I said, hey, he's going to talk to you because he's sort of irked about the way you're handling this. And she was ready for it. She said, and he came in, you know, said some of those things to her. She said, hey, Doc, I've been through depression. This is a breeze. This is a breeze. Nothing, she said. Dying of cancer for her, not of cancer or anybody else, was nothing compared to depression. Depression was all turned up. She longed during depression for an illness that she could blame. That's doing it to me. In depression, you think you're doing it to yourself. And so she had come through all of that, and she said, I've been through all of that stuff. All of that terror, all the anger, all of that turning on yourself. I've done it. It's all behind me. So there again, there was a gift. I forgot to say
that. But you stood up in a different...
Right.
Right.
In a different... Right. I failed to say that.
Well, Elmer is not reacting like I am. Maybe that's the difference between him and I don't know. But I've asked him about it. But I think this year, second year, is much harder for me than my first year. Looking back, I feel I was sort of unaware, kind of numb. I didn't run away from it, but I did get away a little bit. And I came out here 3 months, stayed through Christmas, because I didn't know where to go the first Christmas. And I really wanted to be home and let that house embrace me while we'd been together. But I knew that wasn't very good either. But this year is when I'm having faced reality and go through lots and lots of papers and letters, and which are like a diary of his life. You know, what do I say? What do I give college for records? What do I give to the children? And that's the hard part for me. I mean, there's good things to be going through, just lots of crying and lots of joy. Pulls and that kind of stuff you get rid of early, but it's the other thing that's hard, I think. And nobody can help you with that. It's just something to do. And until that's cleared, I feel like I don't know where to challenge my energy until I'm finished with that.
Up to this point, we've been considering death in harvest of some preparation. There's another time, and that's without preparation. And I dare say I've been through it 3 times.
She said 2 children die and a husband.
Right. All under accidental conditions. So far as my husband was concerned, I was there. He died on my lap. We were in Nepal and under very bizarre conditions, and I won't go into, but nonetheless, he did die. And that was one thing. I was there and it was real to me. But it was the kids who took real go, because they heard about it in an extraordinary way. We had changed our telephone number before we left. We lived in the Washington, D.C. area. So it was an unlisted number. And this is another thing you might remember. The State Department could not get to my family. The way they heard it was from a local policeman, which was one of the worst things that could have happened. And I think that's one of the things I'm still trying to live through after 13 years. So it was certainly bizarre for me, but I think it was far worse for them. And for many, many years now, I have been unable to really be explicit about the details of the death. I was trying to save him. But I think that's a mistake. Because they have enough problems at this point. And I think I should be more articulate. And as a matter of fact, I did next morning. And Henry was there. And I think he appreciated that. But remember that the kids, you remarked about the children being part of it, are very real so far as I'm concerned, but they should not be experienced. And I can also speak to a lot of the things we go through with Virtue and Omega. So far as living through the whole process is concerned, let me tell you that it is hard in the second year, but it's also decreasingly hard as years go by. And you begin to remember that you focus on the good things and not the bad things. And you, once in a while, I wake up in the middle of the night and the bad things go through my head, even now. But I've learned how to put them where they belong. And my life is only one way to go from that forward, and it's not that way.
Thank you.
I'm sitting here in the enormous support system, but now I realize I didn't have any more. My husband died in the military, and the moment he died, I lost all financial support, so I had to move away from where I was, and I decided to go to school. So then I went to school for 2 years, and then I was so busy, and I didn't have a really support system, so I had to keep trying to get through school. Then I took a job, and really, now, 6.5 years later, got the support system in the church that I'm in. So I envy all of you who have something. Don't have to get rid of them.
How about you, Donnie? Do you have a support system? Or don't you want to talk? You can cry if you want to, because I sure cried the night I was on Good Night in front of everybody. And that gives them the liberty to cry with me.
Sure. It's only a year and a half, and a policeman came to the door and told me. It was a Saturday, and Saturdays were so special in our house. I wasn't there. I think it would have helped if I were there. I still think how he's going to come home again.
We all need to support him.
It was such a shock to everybody, and my husband was nationally known, and there was no family in town. But I do have a strong church and strong support from my friends. But it seems the accident happened on Saturday afternoon, and the service wasn't until the following Friday. But it seems I had so many details to take care of, and everybody else was in such shock that I guess I just get the function, and we just could get home from Taiwan, but we weren't sure if she got home, if she could get back to Taiwan. all that got straightened out. And the only way I just felt that I was just poured, filled full of cold, wet cement for months. Just absolutely filled with cold, wet cement. And I was burst out crying, but my friend said I acted like a perfect hostess. I didn't miss a phone call. All the people poured into church. He wasn't at a funeral parlor. They just poured into the house. And I went back to teaching after 5 weeks, and that was a blessing. But I think I still have not, just have not broken down in grief enough. There was too much to do, and if I don't feel that I've read all the books, I don't feel I've gone through those steps in order at all. I never ever got angry. I couldn't get angry at how he believed in heaven so much. And I'm sure he's happy. And somehow I don't understand how he can be happy when he knows I'm alone, because he was an awfully loving person. But I guess our time line is very different. I won't question that too much either, but I think there's a reason for me to come here and leave.
Well, lots of people come here because they're alone. One place where I'm deciding on it. Now I'm a single person. I don't know where I go to vacation. I'm just glad I have Holden to come to. But you don't have to do it. You know, I would feel good at a resort by myself. I know that. I'm just grateful for support. And many of us are like that. And find a chance to talk about these things, and you're not going to have to work with them the next day and say, oh, they're going to remember your story. But at least you've gotten it out of your system. And people are willing to listen. And that means an awful lot. We do have some tapes in the library, by the way, if people want to listen. I think they're Robbins gave one on loss of their child. They lost a son at 26. And,
Granger Westbrook's tapes on the
right. Leo Bustedt has one on loss of a child. So there are lots of helps that you could refer to bring back to your parishes.